no to discrimination, no to hate speech, and no to Bradley.
Wait, what did I do? Hillary's already mad at me?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica
with you.
Radio in Los Angeles. This is the Bradcast, as heard on 90.7 FM in L.A., in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, and 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove, out in Pennsylvania on WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui in Hawaii, up in Minneapolis, St. Paul, AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota, and coast to coast and around the world, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, Radio or Not, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Nashville, Detour Talk in East Tennessee, and blanketing the globe 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik. Glad you could join us. You can run, but you can't hide from the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Voters are lining up to vote in Wisconsin today, as we have been discussing over the past week or so. Some 300,000 already registered voters stand to be kept from casting their vote at all on Tuesday, thanks to the Wisconsin GOP's photo ID voting restriction in use on Tuesday for the first time during a major election, despite being found in a federal court to prevent the votes of far more legal voters than it could possibly prevent fraudulent ones. In fact, as Emily Lonegren explained on the Bradcast yesterday, there is no known case or cases of voter fraud in the state of Wisconsin that might have been deterred by this new voting restriction. And of course, as expected on Tuesday, we're now seeing reports, particularly in college towns, that lines are as long or longer to get the newly required IDs for college students to vote than at some of the polling places. People trying to get IDs, queuing up for, you know, an hour or more to get that ID and then another hour to try and vote. We're keeping our eyes on that today. There's also a very important state Supreme Court election in Wisconsin with the appointment of a Scott Walker appointee on the court. Her name is Rebecca Bradley. She's an old college chum of Scott Walker's, and he has appointed her to pretty much, well, actually, I think every judicial job that she has ever held in Wisconsin, to fill one vacancy after another, on one bench after another in the state of Wisconsin. Now she sits on the state Supreme Court where he appointed her. Well, she's now finally running against an actual accomplished former judge by the name of Joanne Kloppenburg, who Bradblog readers and Bradcast listeners may well remember from 2012, back when Kloppenburg was announced the winner on election night in her race against this controversial right-wing Supreme Court justice up there in Wisconsin. Had Kloppenburg won, then the balance of the court would have been shifted from the right-wingers. And that was just before the state Supreme Court was set to hear Scott Walker, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's union-busting bill. So that was very, very important at the time. Kloppenburg was named the winner on election night, only to lose to that Scott Walker ally, a guy by the name of David Prosser, once thousands of ballots were found the next day in right-wing Waukesha County. And there was never really a proper explanation for what happened there, why those ballots did not get properly accounted for on election night. And it was by a county clerk up there in Waukesha, who we had reported on years earlier as being one of the worst in the state, one that even the right-wing executive board up there in Waukesha had warned time and time again about her practices and about the fact that she, the tabulation computer was an old Windows 95 system kept only in her office. So she had only, the only control over it was by her. In any event, that controversy led to, you may remember, a hand count of all of the ballots across Waukesha County, and actually across the state at the time. And during that count, thousands of ballots were found in bags, in ballot bags that had been torn open, the seals had been broken. And the Nonpartisan Government Accountability Board, which at the time and still oversees elections in Wisconsin, never did a proper review of all of those problem reports that came in. We have photos of them at bradblog.com. We covered it in great detail. The Government Accountability Board largely ignored it and went ahead and certified that that hand count anyway. That the Government Accountability Board will, I think this is going to be their last election on Tuesday, the Wisconsin primary, because the Republicans don't like them, don't like having a nonpartisan group overseeing elections in Wisconsin. So they are doing away with that and replacing them with two partisan commissions that Scott Walker can control. In any event, going back to today, in addition to the primary election on both the Republican and the Democratic side on Tuesday, there is this Supreme Court election where Scott Walker's pal, Rebecca Bradley, is now has to face the voters. And she had written incredibly offensive comments about gay people back when she was a columnist in college in the 90s, more recently about women and rape, abortion and birth control. So the same woman, Joanne Kloppenburg, is now challenging Scott Walker's friend Rebecca Bradley on the Supreme Court, making the election in Wisconsin on Tuesday even more important. Both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have spoken out against Rebecca Bradley. Here was Hillary Clinton yesterday at a rally.
There is a Walker-appointed judge running for the highest court in this state. She compared birth control, which millions of women use every year, to murder. There is no place on any Supreme Court or any court in this country, no place at all for Rebecca Bradley's decades-long track record of dangerous rhetoric against women, survivors of sexual assault, and the LGBT community. So tonight I'm adding my voice to the chorus across Wisconsin saying no to discrimination, no to hate speech, and no to Bradley.
So that was the Bradley she was talking
about.
She
wasn't talking about you.
She wasn't saying no to me. Hi, Desi Doyen. That's
Hello.
Desi Doyen, our producer. No, she wasn't saying no to me. And I'm not saying no to her, to Hillary Clinton. However, I am saying no to the unfair and imbalanced reporting on this race on the Democratic side. You've got this contest up in Wisconsin, poll after poll now showing Bernie Sanders ahead. Now, not ahead by a lot. The average is, according to Real Clear Politics, Bernie Sanders is up above Hillary Clinton by 2.6%. That's averaged out. In most of these polls, he's up over Hillary Clinton by 5 or 6 or 4 or 8 points. Some of them, you know, still within the margin of error, but he's leading in over the last week, 7 different polls. Bernie Sanders is leading over Hillary in 5 of those polls. Hillary Clinton is up only in one, notably, by 6 points. The other one that she's up in, she's up by only 1 point. And yet, on Monday night, Rachel Maddow covered this race, covered this crucial primary in Wisconsin. And I think fairly described, Des, you got to go back and listen to it a little bit closer. Was she fair in her description? She said it was largely a tied race. Bernie was leading in some of the polls.
Yes, her description was quite fair. She said that he seems to be on the leading side of the majority of polls.
And yet, while she was talking, there was one big, huge graphic up on the screen showing Wisconsin Democratic presidential choice, likely Democratic primary voters. And it was a picture of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And it showed Hillary Clinton plus six, a great big, huge blue plus six. And this graphic remained on the screen for at least 30 seconds.
Yes.
And it was the only one that she showed. It was the only poll that she showed. It was this Loras College poll out of Wisconsin. And so you had to sort of stare at this big Hillary plus six Wisconsin Democratic presidential choice graphic showing her up ahead of Bernie 47-41. Now, we had been following these polls and saw that Bernie Sanders had taken the lead by and large from Hillary a week or so ago. And so I went back and I looked at the polling again over at Real Clear Politics, where they list all of the polls. And sure enough, there was a new poll that had just come out yesterday from ARG. That was the one I mentioned where Hillary Clinton was up by 1 point. The other ones, you go down the list, and this is from most recent to the oldest over just the past week. So you had ARG, Clinton plus one. Emerson poll, Sanders plus eight. CBS News, YouGov, Sanders plus two. Fox Business, Sanders plus five. PPP, Sanders plus six. Finally, then you get to the Loras poll from March, from late March, from March 28, March 29, showing Clinton plus six. That was the one they showed on the screen for all of that time during that story about the Wisconsin poll. And then Marquette University poll, which many regard as the gold standard up there in Wisconsin, Sanders up by four. People have accused MSNBC of putting their thumb on the scale for Hillary Clinton, and I think they do so with fairly good evidence to support them, to be frank. For whatever reason, I don't know. I don't know why they want to support Hillary, but, in their coverage, they have leaned towards Hillary. We complained about Rachel Maddow a week or so ago, showing only the delegate totals that included the superdelegates, not the actual voted delegates, and not explaining to viewers what the difference was. So that's a problem, seems to me. And when I went, Desi, to ask you, go find out, if you don't mind, how long actually they were playing that one card, that one graphic showing Hillary up by six, you went online to see if you could grab it. What did you find?
Well, I looked up the that segment on the Rachel Maddow Show on the MSNBC website, and that graphic is no longer there. That graphic showing Hillary Clinton being up six. It was replaced by the list of polls that you just mentioned showing Bernie up instead.
Shows her up by one, and then all of the other, then four more polls that Bernie is leading in. That's for the online version. Why the air version only had that one? Was it a technical glitch? Well, I tried to get a comment from MSNBC and Rachel Maddow, and I finally got one just before airtime, Des. They say that, yes, at 9 p.m., that's their Eastern time, their first showing, we meant to show a recent set of polls with Sanders mostly leading. As the script said, we fixed the graphic for the 12 a.m. re-air and for the web. And then they put the a copy of the corrected graphic. So that's the explanation. I tweeted about the problem today. It made a lot of people angry. But that is the explanation from MSNBC about what happened on the Rachel Maddow Show on the eve of that crucial primary in Wisconsin. All right. In St. Louis County, Missouri, I had also warned about this last week. In Missouri, St. Louis City and St. Louis County are both holding elections, local elections. They had Missouri had their presidential primary a few weeks ago. And because of the speed by which they are having their local elections just a couple of weeks later, officials in Missouri, in St. Louis and St. Louis City and County have said they would not have time to reprogram all of the touchscreens. So they are going to use exclusively paper ballots in both the county and the city for this election on Tuesday. And I begged and I pleaded. Normally they have either touchscreens or paper. They usually point people towards the paper in St. Louis County, which I know because it happens to be my old hometown, St. Louis County, Missouri. But this time they were only going to use paper because they had no time or money to reprogram all of those touchscreens in time. So they're going to use paper ballots. And I had warned, I had begged, I had pleaded St. Louis County to please get it right. Don't pull what happened in Illinois recently on the in the March 22nd primary, where they ran out of paper ballots around the country, around the state, because they had such a high turnout. To not let what happened back in 2014, when St. Louis County also ran out of paper ballots, leading to huge long lines in places like Ferguson. Not long, I think it was the first election after Michael Brown had been killed by the police out there in Ferguson, Missouri, and they ran out of ballots. At the time, we reported exclusively at bradblog.com when election officials were saying, oh, we had no idea. It was just unexpected turnout, unexpected demand. Who knew that voters would be angry after Ferguson? Well, as it turns out, they knew, despite the fact that they told election officials told St. Louis Public Radio the day after the election that, quote, unexpected demand for paper ballots caused a shortage at about 95 polling places throughout the county on Tuesday. And that those paper ballot shortages were the, quote, biggest unexpected problem on Election Day. They weren't unexpected at all. Not at all. And they were warned. Election officials were warned in St. Louis County back in 2014. I got the emails showing going back and forth between election integrity folks out there in Missouri saying, yeah, you guys are planning for, you know, just 15% of the electorate, paper ballots for just 15%. I think you're going to need a whole lot more. And they said, oh, well, we can always print out more if we need to. Well, they couldn't print out more. It led to huge lines. People being turned away, unable to cast their vote. And guess what? That's what we're seeing in St. Louis County again on Tuesday. This time, however, the problems were happening immediately upon opening the polling places. It's just incredible. They're calling now to extend it because on Tuesday morning, the election board was scrambling to deliver ballots to the last of the 24 precincts throughout the county that had no ballots or incorrect ballots on hand when the first voters showed up at 6 a.m. They were already out of ballots or they had the wrong ballots. They completely screwed up in St. Louis County. And by the way, that was after this last snafu in 2014, the election director back then, who I quoted and I spoke with at the time, her name was Rita Days. She was fired after that. They've replaced her with somebody else who was equally good, apparently, at completely screwing up the job.
Wow.
So I guess they don't listen to the broadcast either, because I begged and pleaded for them to get this right.
Well, apparently they don't listen to anybody because it's not like, you know, you don't have the history of recent elections to guide you or what's happened, in the last couple of months, just in a few states that have already had crushing voter turnout.
Yep.
This is unbelievable.
Voters are being asked to return later in the day.
They can do that.
That's easy. Tom Jennings showed up at outside a precinct at Our Lady of Lourdes Parish Elementary School shortly before 6 a.m. to canvass for a candidate out there in University City for the city council. Remember, this is not the presidential election. This is Missouri. This is the local elections. And to my mind, these are just as important as presidential elections. When people need to vote, they need to be able to vote. Jennings said that they had ballots for the very first people that came in, and that was it after that. They ran out, like, immediately. St. Louis Post-Dispatch notes that this botched election on Tuesday fit a pattern of missteps that have plagued voting in St. Louis County for years, in addition to problems with voting machines. Oh, you think? As of Tuesday afternoon, St. Louis County Board of Elections is now petitioning the County Circuit Court to allow polls to extend their hours past the 7 p.m. closing. So if you tried to vote in St. Louis, try to go back. But they're even talking about extending voting onto Wednesday. So that's going on in St. Louis. Up in Wisconsin, we mentioned the photo ID concerns. We will be keeping our eyes on that as the day and the night progresses and as results are reported in what could be a key primary on both the Democratic and Republican sides of the aisle. And of course, we'll have full coverage on tomorrow's broadcast and beyond. As we wait for that, a few other things that are going on, I want to get to. mentioning putting your thumb on the scale. On Monday, Governors Jerry Brown out here in California and Andrew Cuomo in New York both signed legislation to raise their prospective state minimum wages closer to a living wage, to $15 an hour over a matter of years. California's current $10 an hour wage won't get up to all the way up to $15 until 2022. And yet, as you might have expected, the misinformists, I don't know if that's a word, but it is now, and propagandists who are allowed to control our nation's media are out there in full force lying about this. Here was Stuart Varney and three, count them, three guests on Fox Business News today offering, frankly, a breathtaking, uncountable number of lies and disinformation about the minimum wage in less than 90 seconds.
California and New York acted yesterday to push gradually their statewide minimum wage to $15 an hour. But the governor of California made an interesting comment. What did he say, Liz?
He was pretty hesitant. He said, you know, it may not economically work. It may not make sense economically. He said we live in a moral community. Meanwhile, a state legislator in the Central Valley, he's a Democrat, Adam Gray, said this will hurt our small businesses in the Central Valley. Interesting that there's a split in California.
Well, he admitted that it's economically not a good idea.
Right. It's one a terrible Democrat. Idea because anyone running a small business that now is forced by the government to raise wages, they're going to lay people off. So people are going to lose their job over this. Makes no sense.
I hear Todd Horowitz chuntering away in the background there. What do you got to say on the $15 an hour minimum wage, Todd?
It's a killer. It's going to put every business in trouble, and it's going to bring robots instead of people who are going to put robots to work.
Full-time minimum wage job in California pays $30,000 a year when this deal goes through. $30,000 a year for some youngster. Entry-level job, $30,000 a year.
Seven other states pushing for $15 minimum, including Illinois.
No, it's outrageous. Outrageous. How dare people make a proper living? By the way, this is not just, you know, young people. How many millions of Americans are you know, working for minimum wage, trying to support their family? But no, this bill, it's a killer. It will put every business will be in trouble. It will put, quote, most businesses out of business, according to Fox News. And of course, what Fox News didn't bother to note, I don't think, is that, you know, for example, Washington Post reported on April 4 that a leaked poll conducted by Republican pollster Frank Luntz found that 80% of respondents in this poll, respondents who were business executives, actually support raising the state's minimum wage, while only 8% opposed it. I don't know why they didn't mention how business executives feel about this on Fox Business News. But anyway, at least not in that segment. Des, go ahead and play the opposing, because it's Fox News, so they're fair and balanced. Play the opposing clip, the fair and balanced clip from Fox.
Oh, yeah, there isn't one.
What? They didn't put the other side of the argument?
Nope.
I guess then it's left to us. We will cover the other side of the argument and even the Fox side of the argument in a fair and balanced segment next with our friend David Dayan. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. It has been, quote, an absolutely bonkers week for minimum wage hikes, wrote Lydia DePillis at the Washington Post on Friday. And that was before the signings of two minimum wage bills to raise the minimum wage to $15 in both New York and California. On Monday, California decided to raise the state's floor to $15 an hour statewide by 2020. I'm sorry, by 2022. On Thursday night, New York state leaders cut a deal to get to that $15 within 3 years in New York City and 6 years in Long Island and Westchester and $12.50 an hour within 5 years in the rest of the state. The biggest employer in Pennsylvania, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, announced it was raising its minimum wage to $15 by 2021. In Montgomery County, Maryland, County Council members announced a new $15 wage proposal last Thursday. With each new mandate, of course, come warnings of job apocalypse, DePillis notes in the Washington Post, quoting the right-wing Heritage Foundation's James Shirk, bemoaning the District of Columbia's $15 an hour proposal, charging that while the minimum wage sounds compassionate, it will probably hurt the very workers its advocates want to help. It's very nice that he's concerned about that. In fact, studies continue to show that minimum wage hikes, at least to date, have no meaningful effect on employment. In truth, DePillis adds in the Post that even if it does, at higher wage levels, lower turnover costs for employees who don't have to, for employers, I should say, who won't have to then keep hiring new employees all the time because they leave, come and go from these low paying jobs, that would allow businesses to retain staff, and the increased disposable income for low wage workers would then create more jobs in the community. For advocates of minimum wage increases, she explains, the question isn't whether minimum wage hikes will kill jobs, but rather how to help people who end up unemployed when and if they do. So that is a key point. And it seems to be that it's really the only, it's only when it comes to increasing the minimum wage that a lot of folks like the right-wing Heritage Foundation and the folks on Fox Business, they suddenly become concerned about how public policy might affect job loss. Huh, they don't care about it on the trade deals and everything else. Writing about all of this of late, including one righteous rant about it all recently on the Twitters, is our old friend David Day, and he's a financial journalist and contributing columnist at Salon, Fiscal Times, New Republic, Washington Post, and everywhere else. He's also the author of the upcoming book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And it's a really smart book of investigative journalism looking into these people who, these consumers who figured out this great con that was going on. We'll talk about that in a little bit as well. That book comes out May 2016. David Dane, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
My pleasure. I want to ask you about the arguments that were brought up in DePillis's piece in Washington Post, Wonk Blog. Don't know if you saw that. Also about your own recent piece on minimum wage at Salon and that righteous rant I mentioned. But on Friday, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that the U.S. economy grew by some 215,000 jobs in March. That was the 73rd straight month of private sector growth, jobs growth in any event, in the U.S. And yet the unemployment rate ticked up slightly from 4.9% to 5%. How does that happen that we add another 215,000 jobs and yet unemployment goes up? And is this a good thing, that the 73 straight months of private sector jobs growth?
It is a good thing. The reason that the unemployment rate went up is that more people returned to look for work. There were the way the unemployment statistics are calculated, there are millions of people who are effectively uncounted because they have given up looking for work. They have not returned to the job force, whether they've gone to school or they are, you know, just discouraged in some manner or another. What that means that the rate went up is that the denominator is bigger all of a sudden. There are more people looking for work, actively seeking jobs. And that's what we need, because that denominator, that labor force participation rate, has gone down severely during the recession and stayed there. There were millions of people who were just out of the job force. And so this is a good sign that some, you know, the nature of the labor market is such that people are encouraged to come back in and look for work again. So that's actually a good thing.
So we would expect that sort of thing with an improving economy, that you would see more people saying, okay, it is now time to go back and find a job.
Correct. Because it means that the climate is such that they actually think they can manage to find one.
All right. Well, that is good news. And by the way, 73 straight months of private sector jobs growth. Is that a record?
I know. It is actually a record. That you're talking about over 6 years. Now that growth, first of all, came after the largest reduction in the workforce since the Great Recession. Mm. So there was a lot to make up. Furthermore,
since you mean growth, David, you mean since the Great Depression, right?
I'm sorry, since the Great Depression, yes.
And okay.
That growth was fairly low for a long time. So we were very slowly filling that hole that we dug during the Great Recession, following the financial crisis of 2008. So it's not incredibly surprising, but we're saying that for over 6 years there has not been a blip on this radar screen that has dropped private sector job growth. So obviously that's possible.
Okay, well, that is good news. So a deal now has been made to increase the minimum wage to $15 by 2022 in the state of California. Our state, David Dayen.
Our state.
That was struck last week with lawmakers and the governor in California in advance of what had promised to be, as I understand it, two different minimum wage ballot initiatives that were set to be on an upcoming ballot. You wrote a few days ago at Salon that this is a very big deal. Why is this such a big deal? Why is this bigger than similar increases we're beginning to see around the country elsewhere?
Right. I mean, just on the raw numbers, one in every eight workers in America is a Californian.
Mm.
And under this proposal, over 33% of them are going to get a raise at some point along the way between now and 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And thereafter, because after 2022, it goes up with inflation. It gets the minimum wage gets indexed to inflation.
Gets tied to inflation.
Gets tied after 2022.
Would that mean, David, that thereafter we wouldn't have these continual fights because it's just a matter of inflation?
That's
okay.
That's correct, because it would index with inflation.
That seems huge. On its own, that seems a huge element.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, this is a huge deal, especially because, as you alluded to, there was going to be this very messy fight where two factions of the same union in some sort of weird grab for credit were trying to pass their own separate minimum wage measures on the California ballot in November, which was going, the last time that something similar to this happened in California, both of them lost because it's confusing. You don't know if you have to pass one and not pass the other, and it just is a recipe for disaster. So thankfully, all of that was kind of put to the side now that Governor Brown and labor leaders got together to do this. And, it's really a testament to the power of activism. I mean, before the Fight for 15 inaugurated in 2012, nobody would have believed that you could get a $15 an hour living wage minimum in the state of California, in the state as big as California. So really, hats off to the Fight for 15 workers who really pushed this in a tremendous way.
And how much of that, and this sort of gets ahead of where I had hoped to go first, but let me just jump to it for the moment. How much of this would you attribute not just to the Fight for 15, but also, the Sanders campaign has been calling for a $15 an hour minimum wage for some time. Mm-hmm. I think Hillary, she's calling for just $12 an hour. Do I have that?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
But between
and yet the union that endorsed her, the Service Employees International Union, has been basically at the forefront of the Fight for 15. They bankrolled the entire campaign.
And yet she does not call for what it is that union. Okay.
She sent out an approving tweet after California made the deal.
Okay, well,
that's I can say.
The power of the tweet.
What you're getting at is, all of these things, the Fight for 15, Occupy Wall Street, the focus on inequality, Thomas Piketty's book, the Sanders campaign, all of this is rumbling forward and moving Democrats who control states like California and New York into places that they were uncomfortable to go previously. And that is a testament to how this issue of inequality has become the functional primary issue in American politics today.
Is it fair to say, David Dayen, when we see critics of, you know, the old Occupy Wall Street movement, they never got anything done, they dissipated, they were crushed, whatever, they never had any demands. Is it fair to say that it was because of the Occupy movement that all of this stuff suddenly came on the radar back in, 2010, 2011?
I would say that there is no question that as a framing about the 1% and the 99% and income inequality and wealth inequality, Occupy was a catalyzing movement. And 5.6 million workers in California who are going to get a raise in the next several years in part has Occupy Wall Street to thank.
The $15 minimum wage that is now sweeping the nation, as I noted, critics say, this is going to kill jobs. Washington Post describes an emerging view by some what they describe as liberal economists that even if some job loss happens due to minimum wage increases, the overall benefits to workers in the broader economy outweigh them. And perhaps more interesting, those kind of considerations are almost never made in all sorts of other public policies like trade deals and so forth. Yeah. The TPP actually builds in compensation mechanisms for any job losses that might occur.
Next to nothing. I mean, it's like that's like saying you're taking somebody's job, but you'll put a nickel in the tip jar for them.
Well, right. Fair enough. But my point being, when these companies, when these corporations, when they want to see any kind of public policy that might affect jobs in some fashion, well, they'll build in something to deal with that rather than saying, oh, no, we can't do it. We can't have these trade deals because it'll kill jobs. They don't seem to give a damn about that. It only seems to matter when it comes to the minimum wage. Suddenly, they're concerned about job loss. First, is there any real evidence that raising the minimum wage decreases jobs in any substantive way?
Right. Well, I mean, this is new territory. You know, $15 an hour is a level at which we haven't seen in a while. But it's important to understand, we're not going to $15 an hour tomorrow.
Right.
We are getting there through a deliberative process of 6 years in California, where we are at $10 an hour right now.
Yeah.
It goes to $10.50 at the beginning of next year. It goes to $11 at the beginning of 2018, and then raises a dollar for each 4 years after that until you get to 2022. So this hand-wringing on the part of economists and business leaders, we're going to know, we're going to have data for years and years before we get to that actual point. And there are off-ramps in the law that if this is indeed having the terrible effect that these economists claim, there is a mechanism by which the governor can temporarily pause any wage increase from year to year. So it's kind of a silly argument to always be foregrounding this concern. And the point I made on Twitter, which you alluded to, is that we, not just public policy, but we see all kinds of experiments. We see workers used as guinea pigs all the time by businesses, whether it's through just-in-time scheduling, where they decide to schedule you an hour before your job is, starts, or the 401k economy or the 401ks, like moving from a defined benefit system to a defined contribution retirement system, or the freelance economy, moving people from full-time to part-time work. All of these things, all of these experiments that are done on workers, and not these same economists that are so worried about the fate of workers with this experiment with the minimum wage, had never said a darn thing about all of these experiments that hurt workers, that we knew were going to hurt workers at the time because it was literally about cutting their wages and getting rid of their benefits and putting them in hazardous workplaces. It spare me this rhetoric that you care about workers when you've sat by idly over 40 years as work has become more and more and more devalued.
And I'm speaking with David Dayen, a financial reporter and author. David, this underscores kind of a point that I have tried to make over the years, a problem, if you will, or not even a problem, just a fact of capitalism. So I want you to speak to this, David. Tell me if I'm right or wrong, what I'm missing here, what I'm getting. It seems to me that it is a corporation's, a business's fiduciary responsibility to increase profits for shareholders. So all of those things you're talking about, just-in-time scheduling, moving workers from full-time to part-time, that increases their profits. Frankly, that is what they are supposed to do. That's their only real legal responsibility, is to increase profits. So they would be crazy.
Well, let me stop you there,
okay.
However.
Okay, good.
Because that myth of shareholder value, that this is the only thing that corporations are allowed to think about, that this is a rule, that this is an iron law, is a relatively recent phenomenon that was created by Milton Friedman in 1970. Ooh. That he said that shareholder value is the only important thing, that corporations are only exist to produce profit and value for their shareholders. Prior to that, we had a thing called managerial capitalism, where managers had many concerns. It was not just the concerns of shareholders. It was the concerns of their community. It was concerns of the workers that worked for them. It was the concerns of the long-term value and health of the company. And all of those things legally are still inputs that managers can make to determine various policies throughout their corporation.
Well,
it is not the case. It is not a legal imperative that only shareholders have to benefit from a corporation.
Understood. I'm not saying that that's the only thing that they can do, but I'm saying that ultimately
it's what it's become, though.
Okay.
And it's become that over the last 30, 40 years, and this is a propagandistic way in which it has become that because people like Milton Friedman and his acolytes shouted that for years and years and years, and that became the watchword of the business world. My view is we need to break that myth and realize that this doesn't even do well for shareholders when you do that.
Well, okay, fair enough. And I should say, no relation to Milton Friedman. He is not my uncle.
No,
I am not.
I'm aware of that.
But the point being, with this idea in mind and that has taken hold over the past 30 or 40 years, whether it is correct or not, my point is that in fact, corporations do need to make a profit or do want to make a profit. That's what they're going to keep their eye on in so many cases. So therefore, we need these type of government mandate. You need the government to come in and make a mandate to assure the broader health or the general welfare, if you will, of the people and the economy that we live in.
Right.
So they're not required to be nice. Corporations are not required to be nice to their communities or to their employees.
No.
And that's why you need the government to do this, right?
Bottom line.
Yeah.
It would actually improve their bottom line if they happen to be.
Right.
Would be my theory and the theory of managerial capitalism.
Fair enough. But you need the government to come in and say, you're not just going to do this for fun. If you're not going to help us close the the wage gap between the rich and the poor, then it needs to be mandated. That's the only way that it ultimately seems like it's going to happen.
There's obviously a role, and actually the role begins with the corporate charter, which governments give to corporations, and they can extract promises and guarantees in exchange for that corporate charter. We've gone completely away from this idea that corporations have a responsibility by virtue of the charter that governments grant upon them. And I would like to see us get back to that point in some way. But you are correct that government can play a role when corporations act in in a pure self-interested manner for the benefit of executives and shareholders.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and that is part of what we're seeing. It's a backlash to decades of productivity and wages separating, where the productivity of businesses has gone way up and the wages have remained stagnant. In other words, the workers are not participating in the fruits of their own labor. They're not reaping the benefits that they created. And so it is the role of government to try to rebalance that. And the wage is just, minimum wage is just one tool in that toolbox. In increasing the power of collective bargaining is another tool in that toolbox. Using things like the earned income tax credit that rewards work and supplements it is another tool in that toolbox.
Well,
there are plenty of them.
Right. Well, and you argue that government can do this. I'm arguing that government must do this because these companies are not going to do it on their own. Some of them may be smart enough to realize, oh yeah, if we have a happier workforce, that's going to be better overall for our company. But as you note, over the past 30, 40 years, that doesn't seem to happen very often. And it seems like now, therefore, it requires these mandates in order to bend the curve of what we've seen for so many years with the wage gap.
Is you can make that require.
Yeah,
it's true. But all I'm saying is you can require to make that. You can make that requirement much earlier.
Okay.
Along the game, which is through the dispensation of the corporate charter, you can force a lot of policies through, and that's I think of kind of an unseen. Potential area. There's also, the fact that we have this extreme market concentration, and the U.S. has laws that have been on the books for over a century to break that stranglehold and use the antitrust laws to promote competition. If you have competition, you're going to have competition for better wages.
So you mean extreme market concentration? You're talking about monopolies or near monopolies by the big banks and the big corporations and so forth.
Big everything.
Big everything. Exactly.
Supermarket. Yeah. 10 companies make everything in your supermarket.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are a host of ways that government can get involved in this and fix this. The minimum wage is one, and it's really captured the imagination of the activists. And the public is responding. As we know, even in down years for Democrats, minimum wage ballot measures succeed in red states like Alaska and South Dakota. This is something that the public basically believes this fundamental point, that if you are working full time, you should be able to support yourself. And that's sort of the fundamental idea behind a living wage, and this claim that it will hurt workers if you give them a raise so that they can actually support themselves is really kind of meritless.
And the argument being pointed out by some of these economists now is that, well, if we lose some jobs, maybe that's okay, that these were crap jobs in the first place that don't pay enough. And that overall, the benefits...
Nobody should go to work for 40 hours a week and not be able to afford a place to live or food on their table or health care or any of these basic necessities. And it is okay to get rid of crap jobs and force corporations to whoever they hire to make sure that they're taken care of and at a basic level. We're not talking, $30,000 a year is what you would get 50 hours a week working at, 50 weeks a year, 40 hours a week working at $15 an hour. These are not princely wages.
No, not at all.
These are things that are completely affordable to corporations that make hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars and have a lot of them stashed overseas.
David, I've already taken you a few more minutes than I had promised I would. I don't know if you have another minute or two. Did you hear? I'd love to play this this audio. This was a couple of weeks ago. It was only just brought to my attention from Asher Adelson. Did you happen to see this on CNBC? This guy.
No, just play it.
Yeah, he was a stockbroker. Apparently, the Gordon Gekko character in Wall Street was somewhat based on this guy. He goes on CNBC in this, what do they call it, Godfathers of Wall Street segment. He's asked about the economy, and he made two points of note. I want to play both of them for you. Here's the first one. I want to get your reaction to this.
You say that we are currently in a recession. Every Fed official who speaks to us tells us we are not in a recession. What are they missing?
I think it's pretty straightforward. The average American has not had an increase in pay in 15 years, but things have cost more in the marketplaces. He has been in a recession for 15 years. Nothing's changed for him. Up at the top, we're not in a recession, but 80% of the Americans have been in a recession for at least 15 years.
So how does that translate into investing into the stock market? Is it that it's a recession that nobody seems like nobody realizes we are in one, and certainly nobody realized we've been in one for 15 years?
Who is your nobody?
I think the broader investing public, if you polled anybody on the street or anybody on this desk
It sounds like you're talking more about financial oppression than you are an economic decline. I mean, I get the fact that a lot of people aren't doing as well because structurally society isn't rewarding them maybe where they should. I'm not going to get into that.
That's a social issue. I'm talking about money and economics. People can buy less for what they have now than they could 15 years ago. In their lives, that's a recession.
Pretty good, David.
Tremendous. Yeah,
nobody thinks we're in a recession. This was a panel of folks on CNBC all disagreeing with this guy.
Thinks except for the 80% of people he just described.
And one more clip I want to play because this you have to see the video to see the expression on the CNBC's folks' face when they asked Asher Adelman, again, the guy who was the character of Gordon Gekko in Wall Street was based on. When he asked him this question, go ahead.
We're asking everybody essentially who you think the best candidate for the economy would be.
Bernie Sanders.
Without a doubt. Why is that?
No question. Well, I think it's quite simple again. If you look at something called velocity of money, you guys know what that is, I presume. Mm-hmm. That means how much gets spent and turns around. When you have the top 1% getting money, they spend 5-10% of what they earn. When you have the lower end of the economy getting money, they spend 100 or 110% of what they earn. As you've had a transfer of wealth to the top and a transfer of income to the top, you have a shrinking consumer base, basically. And you have a shrinking velocity of money. Mm-hmm. Bernie is the only person out there who I think is talking at all about both fiscal stimulation and banking rules that will get the banks to begin to generate lending again as opposed to speculation.
Okay.
So from an economic point of view, it's straightforward.
So you had to see their faces, David, when he said Bernie Sanders. I guess you can imagine that doesn't happen on CNBC.
It does not happen a lot on CNBC. But, you know, I mean, what he's talking about with the velocity of money, this is a key point that gets made in these minimum wage debates, or it should at least, is that when you increase wages, give a raise to people who are making $8, $9, $10 an hour, they're going to spend that money that they get because they'll need to spend it for basic necessities. And that increases the velocity of money. It circulates more money through the economy. It might spur the need for more workers because you're going to have more economic activity and more needs on consumer needs on the part of those people.
Why don't we hear more? Yeah.
We very rarely talk about the minimum wage in those terms, but it's you're giving more money to people who have a bigger propensity to spend it, rather than having that money go into the corporate coffers and go to some executive who has no need to spend it.
It seems like a no-brainer when it's put that way. You know, poor people get money, they spend it. It immediately goes into the economy. That was the argument that's been made. You know, even for food stamps, that stuff, that money goes into the unemployment and so forth. That goes into the economy, unlike with the rich people. Before I let you go, David Dayan, do you have an opinion about which presidential candidate would be best for the economy? That question that Asher Adelman just answered?
I mean, I think he looks at it in an interesting way. Obviously, there's the practical issue that presidents aren't dictators, and they have to work with Congress to get something passed. And, you know, it, viewed through that lens, I'm not sure anybody would to do anything if we assume that the gerrymandering of the Republican districts holds. Now, it might not. You might get a Democratic majority in the House, although that's somewhat doubtful. So you have to sort of look at it through those practicalities. There are things that presidents can do without passing legislation. It's somewhat limited, but I think in terms of better oversight, management, and most important, the sort of viewpoint that those key policymakers would take, not about, you know, propping up Wall Street or engaging in things that benefit corporations, but really looking out for workers. You know, you can definitely see that Bernie would have that viewpoint really right at the center of his administrative.
You don't get to go on CNBC, David Day, and that's not the right answer.
Well, if Asher does, then why not me?
Apparently, he kept it a secret until they asked him about it. David Day, a financial journalist, contributing columnist at Salon, Fiscal Times, everywhere else, and the author of the upcoming fascinating book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. You can and should pre-order it now. I had hoped to talk about it a bit more this time, David, but we didn't get to it. That only means I get to have you back and we get to talk about it in more detail in the near future.
There we go. We'll do it.
Thank you, sir. Greatly appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon. Running late, quick break, and we are back with more broadcast and some debate news right here. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Okay, only time for a very quick note here. Desi Doyen, they have added another Democratic debate next week.
Oh, boy.
Well, don't sound so happy about it.
That's just a lot of work.
Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton will face off in Brooklyn, which is Bernie Sanders' hometown. And, of course, in Hillary Clinton's sort of home state, because she was the senator there. So there will be yet another debate. Buckle up for that next week. Of course, we'll have full coverage of Wisconsin primary results and whatever other messes happen up there in the Badger State on tomorrow's broadcast. Until then, my thanks to you, Desi Doyen, our producer, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn, to David Dayan of Salon and Fiscal Times, and of course to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, download it at bradblog.com or over at iTunes, where you can subscribe. It's free. And drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Twitters and the Facebooks, I am simply The Brad Blog. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.